Hello, and thank you for joining this MedCast series titled Applying the Latest Evidence to Delay the Onset of Type 1 Diabetes. I am Diana Isaacs, an endocrine clinical pharmacy specialist and the Continuous Glucose Monitoring Program Coordinator at the Cleveland Clinic Diabetes Center in Cleveland, Ohio.
And I am Natalie Bellini, a nurse practitioner specializing in diabetes management with the R&B Medical Group in Williamsville, New York. Today, we'll discuss the latest clinical evidence on new and emerging treatments that can delay the onset of type 1 diabetes.
To discuss more on this, we are joined now by Dr. Emily Sims, a pediatric endocrinologist at Riley Hospital for Children and a physician scientist in the Indiana University Center for Diabetes and Metabolic Diseases and the Herman B. Wells Center for Pediatric Research. We are so excited to have Dr. Sims here, who was an integral part in the teplizumab clinical trials. Well, we are so excited to have you here, Dr. Sims. To begin with, can you just describe for us the stages of type 1 diabetes and discuss why interventions that delay the clinical progression of type 1 diabetes are so important?
Sure. So the stages of type 1 diabetes kind of start officially once someone has multiple islet autoantibodies that test positive. So once you have at least two positive islet autoantibodies, at that point, we know that your lifetime risk of developing type 1 diabetes approaches 100%. And so we would call someone stage 1 type 1 diabetes once they've developed multiple islet autoantibodies. So then kind of once you reach the threshold of starting to have changes in your blood sugar, but you don't yet reach the American Diabetes Association criteria for diagnosing diabetes, that's a person who would say has stage 2 type 1 diabetes. So kind of starting to have changes in your beta cell function and your glycemia, but kind of not yet reaching those clinical criteria, that would be stage 2 diabetes. And then now we consider stage 3 diabetes as someone who used to say had new onset diabetes. So, you know, having that A1C of greater than 6.5%, having an oral glucose tolerance test, 2-hour glucose value of greater than 200, or fasting blood sugar of greater than 126, and then clinical symptoms of diabetes, we would call stage 3 diabetes.
So with stage 2 diabetes, let's talk a little bit about that so that our listeners and our viewers can understand that a little bit more. What happens first? So I think the interesting part about diagnosing diabetes is we look at fasting blood sugars. But can you talk about why that might not be ideal?
Yeah. So in type 1 diabetes, fasting blood sugars are probably one of the later things to change as you kind of progress along that spectrum to stage 3 disease. So we know that, you know, actually when your beta cells and your pancreas make insulin, there's kind of two phases of that insulin production in response to sugar or some kind of exposure, meal exposure. There's this kind of big surge that you get and then a later phase of insulin secretion. So in type 1 diabetes, early on that first phase of insulin secretion is the thing that changes. And so those kind of stimulated time points of that insulin secretion are what we see differences in early on. And so then it takes a long time to see changes in the fasting blood sugar. So early on, you're going to see changes in early insulin secretion and maybe later time points or intermediate time points of an oral glucose tolerance test when you're testing somebody for diabetes. And so I think that kind of testing at earlier phases can really kind of help you identify people really early when there's an opportunity to intervene and make a bigger difference than if you wait until you see changes in that fasting number.
Thanks for explaining that. That was a really, really good explanation. So I know you've been involved with the clinical trial with teplizumab, which has now been FDA approved to delay the onset of type 1 diabetes. So yeah, I mean, kudos to you and your team for all that amazing work. So can you tell us a little bit, how does it work? Like, what is its mechanism of action?
Yep. So it is really exciting. This is a huge, huge landmark step for people who've been working on therapies that target underlying pathophysiology of disease and type 1 diabetes. So this drug is a monoclonal antibody to CD3, which is a protein that's on the surface of T cells. And so what this drug does is in the trial that the FDA approval is based on, you give a 14-day infusion of this drug and it causes a temporary depletion in people's T cells. And then as those T cells recover, hopefully less of the kind of bad T cells that attack your pancreatic beta cells, increase. And then you also, the people who respond the most to this drug seem to have an increase in, they call them partially exhausted CD8 T cells. And so again, those are the type of T cells that kill your beta cells that make insulin. And so they're kind of a little less autoreactive, and they're less likely to kind of be really, really active against those beta cells. And so you have less beta cell killing.
Wow, what a great response, right? Yeah. That is perfect.
That was
great.
Yeah.
That was just what we wanted to hear, right? So you're almost calming down that T cell activation. You're almost saying, stop doing what you shouldn't be doing in the first place.
Yeah, exactly. And I think another important thing to think about is that, you know, for this treatment, it was a one-time course of this drug, right? And so people had the temporary depletion, but then things kind of go back to normal, right? And so they still had this kind of pretty long effect of the drug, even though it was only a one-time treatment with the drug.
So I think it's really exciting. Now there's a lot of efforts, or there's starting to be a lot of efforts to screen people, like things like TrialNet. I'm curious your thoughts. So once someone has those autoantibodies, you know, I know in the trial, a glucose tolerance test was done. What do you think about maybe using CGM to identify that stage two versus doing a glucose tolerance test?
Yeah, I think that there's some great data out of the Barbara Davis Center that CGM metrics can be helpful to identify people who are really high risk of screening. The only kind of issues with CGM are, you know, it's kind of dependent on what people eat is one issue, right? So it's like a little less standardized than the oral glucose tolerance test. And it seems like the data can be pretty variable too. I think they can be more variable than with the OGTT data. So I think that, you know, it's something that's appealing. And I think as we're kind of thinking about rolling screening out to more and more people in the population, we're going to have to be a little bit more flexible about the things that are going to work for different people and how to identify different people. Because at the end of the day, the more people that are getting monitoring, maybe it's not the kind of gold standard perfect monitoring, right? But if it can be applied to more people, I think that's the thing that's the most important. And so I think we're going to be thinking a lot more about, okay, so maybe oral glucose tolerance tests aren't going to work for you, but what are the other things that we know can give us good information that might be useful? You know, maybe even hemoglobin A1C screening for some people too, right? Because it's just one finger stick, even though it's maybe not quite as sensitive as that oral glucose tolerance test. Maybe if someone has an increase in their hemoglobin A1C, it could give you a lot of information, right?
Yeah, that's a good point. That would be a lot easier, a lot more convenient to do.
And maybe in the beginning, what you do is you put a sensor on the patient and say, look at these spikes. Now we need to do an official test that actually, because it's part of the FDA approval, right? And even for the finger stick, like, I mean, I think, you know, we've had families who have called and said, we think our son has type one. I'm like, well, go give him some pancakes and syrup and check his blood sugar and call me back, right? I mean, that same idea is, are you seeing the spike or not? Then we can put you into this protocol, right?
And do the more official testing. I agree.
Right. So I think that's a big part of it too.
Yeah. I think it's going to be really interesting, these kind of next steps, now that we have something to intervene, right? Like, we need to think about ways to identify more and more people that are going to benefit, because depending on where you live, a lot of the screening that's available is really only to family members, right? And so, you know, more and more general population screening is going to become available. And then I think another really big need is kind of consensus monitoring guidelines for these people who we know are at risk, who are antibody positive, because there's kind of different things out there, but I think it would be really nice to have clear guidance, especially for like family practitioners and primary care providers who are going to be seeing these patients a lot, right? And need to have a plan for what to do with them.
Right. These aren't our patients. I mean, as a person who practices endocrinology, these aren't my patients yet, right? They're going to be if they're positive, but they're not yet. So how do I get the pediatrician, the primary care, the family practice groups to screen for these so that the patient is identified as quickly as possible and we really can move forward?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, there's a big need for education now, right? Because a lot of people aren't familiar with the idea of stages of diabetes, but yeah, like kind of clear guidelines for monitoring. And then I think it's a no-brainer, you know, for people who are family members in the United States, because they can get screened for free through TrialNet. But if it's someone who doesn't have a family history, then it's a little bit more complicated. So there are some states that have screening programs that are available. And then JDRF has a link on their website to screening that people can pay for or do through insurance. But definitely some of the kinks need to be ironed out of that, I think.
Yeah, because I mean, a lot of people that get type 1 diabetes don't even have a family history. Right. So it's kind of like, well, who should
most
we screen?
People, right?
Should
exactly.
We screen anyone with any type of autoimmune disorder in their family? Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of questions. Yeah.
There's been some talk about potentially including genetic screening for high genetic risk for type 1 diabetes on the newborn screen. And so then people who, you know, would be really high risk then could get followed up over time with autoantibodies. But it's very interesting. You know, that would be a big paradigm shift on the newborn screen, right? Because it's not diagnosing something, it's just diagnosing a high genetic risk for something. And so there's many, many logistics that need to go into place. But I think, you know, potentially really, really exciting and opportunities to intervene early in disease and change that kind of natural trajectory for a lot of people.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for sharing all of your knowledge and wisdom with us. We really enjoy talking with you today and having you here. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. This was really fun, you guys. Thanks for inviting me. I appreciate it.
Can you describe a little bit the patient population and the study design for the clinical trial for teplizumab?
Yeah. So the study that the FDA indication was based on was a prevention study. So it was people who didn't have kind of what we classically consider as clinical diabetes yet. So they actually met criteria for stage 2 diabetes. So these were people who were relatives of people with type 1 diabetes. They were 8 to 45 years of age. And so they were stage 2. So they already had at least 2 of those islet autoantibodies, and they were already having changes in their blood sugars on an oral glucose tolerance test. So, you know, you have them drink the Glucola and then you're starting to see changes in blood sugars, but not yet meeting those diabetes criteria. So these are people who we know are at super, super high risk of progression of clinical diabetes, kind of like right on the edge of getting diabetes. And then they were followed over time after that kind of one-time 14-day course of drug with these oral glucose tolerance tests. They did them 3 months after drug and then 6 months and then every 6 months over time to kind of catch diabetes really, really early and see if there was any difference in the rates of diabetes development in the people who got placebo or drug.
So would you be able to share some of the key findings from that trial? You know, how did teplizumab group compare with placebo in terms of that type 1 diabetes progression?
Yeah. In the first study that got published in the New England Journal, I think in 2019, they were able to see that treatment with drug was associated with about a 2-year delay in progression of diabetes compared to people who got placebo. And then we actually did a follow-up study a couple of years later that was looking at how people's beta cells made insulin in response to drug versus placebo and followed people up for longer. And we saw that the effect of drug on the progression of diabetes actually lasted closer to 3 years. It was 32 and a half months compared to placebo, which was super exciting. And then the other thing that was really, really neat is when you look at the way that people's beta cells make insulin before and after they get the drug. So, you know, if you follow these people over time before they got treatment, their amount of insulin that they're making is decreasing, decreasing, decreasing. You know, these are people who are kind of like right on the edge of getting diabetes. They're, you know, kind of right about to go over the cliff. But then that continued to be the case for people in the placebo group. But in the people who got drug, you see this really cool reversal where they start to increase their insulin production at 3 months. And then at 6 months, where they looked significantly different from the placebo group. So not only was diabetes delayed, but it seems like people's beta cells were working better early on after they got this drug pretty quickly.
That's incredible.
It is.
Yeah.
Speaking of that, I was actually just curious because I know there's also the ongoing PROTECT study, which is being done in people with already diagnosed type 1 diabetes to protect their beta cells. And I believe the protocol for that is a 12-day infusion. So I'm just curious if the rationale, if you can share why this one was 14 days, but that one is being done with 12 days.
Yeah, I think it's really just about convenience for patients, right? So everyone's super, super excited about, you know, the possibility of these kinds of therapies, but then there's kind of the, okay, what are the logistics of getting this out to people, right? And so a 14-day infusion means 2 weekends that have to be covered and figuring out, you know, weekend coverage for people. And so, you know, wouldn't it be great if you could get the same effect with a 12-day infusion? And so that's the idea, I think, with putting it down to 12 is probably, it has the same benefit. And if it could really help patients and be a lot easier for patients to get the drug, then it would be great. Right. And then the PROTECT study, the idea with that study is that in people who have stage 3 diabetes, I think it's testing kids, and they're testing 2 doses of the drug, kind of right after people get diagnosed and at 6 months with the idea that, you know, the prevention study was just one course, right? So maybe if you could give people kind of a second dose, you could really prolong the effect with drug. And so this study would be, the goal would be to preserve people's C-peptide production. So for people who don't study diabetes, C-peptide is the way that we measure someone's endogenous insulin production. For people who are taking insulin or getting treated with insulin. And the idea here is that, you know, we know that people who have type 1 diabetes who are still making some of their own C-peptide long-term do much better. It's much easier to manage their diabetes. They usually require less insulin with less low blood sugars. And then in terms of diabetes complications, they also do a lot better over time. So that would be the goal with treating right at diagnosis.
So I have a really good question. Of all the studies you've done, what's the longest? So we talk about this, you know, 24 months or 32 months. What's the longest? Because I think some people that we've talked to as clinicians have said it's only 2 years. How long can it be? And again, this is all brand new. And so I think people need to understand that this is just the first step. But I would love to know more about how long you have prolonged. And why do you think, what is the role then of this zinc, the anti-zinc co-transporter antibody versus any other ones? So that's a two-part question.
Okay. So first question is kind of what's the drug that's had the longest effect on delaying diabetes? So this is the only drug that's ever been shown to successfully delay diabetes. So this is the drug for sure that's had the longest effect. But I think that so two things. First of all, you know, this drug we know has an almost 3-year delay on the effect to having to time of diabetes, which, you know, if you think about particularly for like a little kid, you know, who's like a really high risk of progressing to diabetes, if you think about 3 years and someone who has, you know, a child and not having to take insulin, man, that's like, you know, maybe getting through a formative period, right? Maybe getting through adolescence, you know, where that could really, really make a big difference in your quality of life, I think. And you know, it's going to be an individual decision, right? But I think it's actually something that could really, really impact people and their quality of life. That said though, I think you really hit the nail on the head when you said this is kind of just the first step, right? So there's the possibility of repeated dosing when people kind of start decreasing their own insulin production again. And then I think most of the people who are in this area think that probably we're going to have to do some kind of combination therapy long-term. So I think next steps are going to be, you know, using other kinds of agents that target other kinds of mechanisms that maybe could be used in addition to teplizumab. So that we could kind of attack this from multiple angles and have a longer duration of effects and, you know, ultimately maybe even a cure, right? But I think for sure we can find combinations that prolong the need for insulin for a longer period of time. So that was the first part. And then the second part was about different kinds of autoantibodies and if that makes a difference. I think for sure, we know that depending on which autoantibody you present with, that can be reflective of different kind of phenotypes of type 1 diabetes. And people are recognizing more and more that type 1 diabetes is probably actually a heterogeneous disease with different people presenting different ways. So for example, we know that age, at the time that you present, the age that you present with type 1 diabetes can be associated with really, really different phenotypes where people who present as little kids have usually a much more severe disease course. They kind of progress more rapidly. They lose their own insulin production more quickly versus people who present as adults when things kind of seem to move a lot more slowly. And so there have been some studies that have shown differences in which autoantibody kind of presents first and which ones you have and how that may be associated with differences in the way that you present with disease. And I think the kind of holy grail is we can kind of identify these kinds of differences, including which autoantibodies are positive and kind of be able to understand what kind of treatments would work the best for different people who have those different phenotypes so that we can kind of provide a more precision approach and give the best treatment for each individual person. But for now, the numbers are still kind of small and we're still so early, right? So I think those are kind of steps down the line that we need to cross later.
That's really interesting. So I know while 2 or almost 3 years was the median, obviously some people were shorter or longer. So I'm curious, like what was the longest? Like how long did it delay in some people for type 1 diabetes?
Yeah. You know, it's a little hard to answer that question because, you know, you always want to compare people to placebo, right? Because even though we were kind of selecting everybody at stage 2, there's probably individual features that, you know, make one person like not be as likely to get diabetes as rapidly than another person. But the last time we followed up the data, there were some people who had gotten drug that it had been over 5 years and they still hadn't progressed to diabetes. And I know that Kevin Harold, who's the person who kind of has really been the person who's headed to teplizumab in type one is planning on looking at people who are kind of long-term responders to teplizumab and seeing if he can understand some of the kind of individual features that predicts the best response in those individuals.
And I truly love the idea of then saying, okay, you're a long responder and maybe this is the only drug you need, but you're a short responder. And now let's put these two together. You might get teplizumab and something else 6 months later, or you might need teplizumab every 6 months for years. But if you never develop full-blown type one, haven't we done something in the right direction, right? I mean, that's the goal. You know, is you mentioned young children. What if I can get that young child through college? I think most of them would raise their hand and say, infuse me every 6 months. I've got 12 days or however many days it turns into.
Yeah. And you know, it may be, I think a lot of people think it may end up that there's some kind of regimen that involves an induction kind of therapy that's something like teplizumab or antithymocyte globulin, you know, where you have this kind of big hammer that kind of depletes T cells and then they recover. But then you have a maintenance therapy as well that's, you know, kind of a less big gun, right, that you could take for longer with kind of less immunomodulation so that it could be a long-term treatment. And I totally agree, you know, even if you have to start insulin, maybe if it's like really low doses or just basal or something like that, right, I think it still would make a really big difference in quality of life and really be moving that needle forward.
So I think the question a lot of people have is, well, what are the side effects? You know, how well tolerated is teplizumab? And we know, you know, it's the infusion. Are the side effects just during the infusion? Or are there some that are kind of lingering later on? Can you share some of that?
Yeah. And in the prevention study, it was really well tolerated. As we kind of mentioned, the logistics of kind of getting a 14-day infusion are kind of annoying, right? So that's one thing. And then, you know, you have this drop in your T cells that recovers kind of over that next month or so. And so that you have to be really careful and make sure you're being careful in terms of infectious exposures. But really, people tolerate the drug really well. The kind of biggest side effect in this study was that a lot of people get a rash that usually gets treated with Benadryl, but can be itchy. But that's the kind of main issue that people had. But otherwise, it was really well tolerated, and there were no kind of really serious safety issues in the study.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is amazing because usually we start with, okay, tell us the side effects, and it's 10 minutes of discussion, right? And there really aren't, and patients do, they tolerated it very, very well.
Yeah. So I'm curious what, we talked a little bit, we brushed up a little on the PROTECT study, but kind of what's next for this drug? Cause I imagine we're not stopping here, right? So what is next for teplizumab? Even if you can share some top line results from PROTECT or if there's other future studies that are planned as well.
Yeah. So I think, I don't have results yet from PROTECT, but I think, one thing is, you know, extending the indication potentially to the new onset population, you know, looking at efficacy there. Another thing I think is extending the age groups that it's eligible for. So, you know, the FDA indication was based on the prevention study, which started at age 8 was the lowest age. But we know, you know, kind of as we mentioned, little kids who are presenting could really, really benefit from a 3-year delay in their diabetes diagnosis and are the ones who are often progressing the most frequently and are the ones we're kind of hearing about the most, right? And so I think TrialNet, who is the international trial group that put on the initial prevention study, is looking at doing a trial in little kids to look at efficacy of the drug in stage 2. And then I think the other thing everyone's thinking about is combination regimens, right? So what's going to be a great combination to put with this drug to improve that duration of effect? And so I'm not aware of a combination trial that has started yet, but there is lots of talk about, you know, like what those could look like. I'm a big beta cell person, so I think it would be really cool to try something like verapamil or a drug that targets beta cell health in combination with teplizumab and see how if that makes the effect last for longer.
So one of the things I think we should revisit in this discussion is the staging of diabetes. So 10 or 20 years ago, there wasn't really staging at all. Either you didn't have type 1 or you did have type 1. So we asked Dr. Sims to revisit that when she discussed it too. Type 1 staging is where you're antibody positive, but there are no symptoms. But there's also no change in blood sugar fluctuation. So if you give someone a glucose tolerance test, they produce plenty of insulin still, but the antibodies are doing their magic and working against those beta cells. And then we have stage 2, where the antibodies are positive, and yet during a glucose tolerance test, that those blood sugars start to rise. And that was that first phase insulin response that she was discussing. That's the hardest time that you need the most insulin is when you eat carbohydrates. So if you think about that as a clinician, that makes the most sense, is that that would fail first and not the fasting blood sugar. When you think about fasting, the patient has had all night to make enough insulin to get that blood sugar down when you check it.
So can you tell us, I know when someone has two or more autoantibodies, what's the chance that they're going to develop type 1 diabetes?
Almost 100% in their lifetimes. And so in the beginning, we thought about diabetes as something that came on as a child. It was juvenile onset for so many years. We have lots of patients who get it as a child, right? But we also have lots of people who get it as an adult. And you and I both have had patients in their 60s, 70s, 80s develop type 1 diabetes. How do we know how long they were antibody positive? We don't. But you have a 100% chance or close to it if you have two or more antibodies positive.
Yeah. I mean, the staging system is really interesting. I think there's not a ton of awareness about it. It is, you know, it's in the ADA standards of care, but I don't think a lot of people are aware of it. And especially in adults where type 1 diabetes tends to be more slow progressing, I think the staging is really very, very helpful. For example, I guess it's not so common, but I've experienced it in a number of my patients where a woman is diagnosed with gestational diabetes, right? And then come to find out she actually has the autoantibodies. And I've seen a number of cases where the endocrinologist, someone thought, hey, you didn't seem like a person, you know, you didn't have the characteristics that might put you at higher risk of developing gestational diabetes. Let's go ahead and check those autoantibodies. And sure enough, they've had them. But the neat thing about it is we've been able to catch it so early that in terms of the treatment, often we don't have to go straight to needing basal bolus insulin or using an insulin pump, that we're actually, when you catch it really early, especially in adults where it's slower progressing, we can start off sometimes with even other therapies, like with using metformin, but often maybe just with a long-acting insulin and not requiring mealtime insulin. So it's really interesting. I think there's a lot of benefits to this staging and to early detection.
Yes. And think about, when you think about diabetes, type 1 diabetes and the burden that comes with the management, the day-to-day management, every time you look at food, every time you think about how far is the gate that I walk to at the airport, is that going to drop my blood sugar? What's going to happen next? There is a real burden that comes with this disease. I think that knowing ahead of time and using therapies as quickly as possible and addressing them as opposed to waiting will be a real option for patients.
So I'm curious your thoughts on this. So yeah, so of course there is a burden, but now we do have so many better tools, so many better technologies. We've got all these automated insulin delivery systems. I mean, I've got a number of patients that are easily able to, you know, get that 70, 80% time in range. So what do you think with all the new technologies, is it still as much of a burden? Do we still, you know, should prevention or should cure, is it still important?
I think it is. And I think some of the reasons are that we don't know. It's very hard sometimes. We can all talk about the person with diabetes who's had an A1C of 12 and they end up with eye disease, right? And those people that suffer and that they're trying to just get food on the table and trying to get their heat turned on a regular basis, their blood sugar sometimes can reflect those challenges in their lives. You know, the social determinants of health with type 1 diabetes are very similar to the social determinants of health with type 2 diabetes and the management of it all and the overwhelming feeling. So AID, automated insulin delivery, is still not for everyone. And I have amazing patients who do very, very well. But I also have a lot of patients who really struggle, even with amazing technology that wasn't here 20 years ago, to get to goal and not feel like that's all they do every day. So I think that there is a place for delaying the onset. You could choose not to use the medication. You know, we always want to provide a fair and balanced discussion. And this is a harder one because if you don't use the drug, there isn't another drug option. But you could just wait for the diabetes to come, you know. And I don't know that we can always pick the patient that will suffer or have higher burden from the disease than other people. Because you and I both have both patients who seem to suffer a lot and who just struggle with the management, the daily management, and others who don't have that same challenge with it. They don't like it. They never wake up and say, this is a great diabetes day. But they also don't have the depression and some of the other things that kind of come with that wear and tear of diabetes on a daily basis.
Yeah, I'm with you. I mean, I'm thrilled with all the different tools and the technologies we have. And I do tell my patients, I'm like, this is, if you have to develop diabetes, like this is the best time in history to have it because we have all these tools. But the reality is, for automated insulin delivery at this time, it does require wearing two sites. Your pump, you have your CGM. Maybe at some point it'll be consolidated into one, but it's still wearing something all the time. And when you wear something, it's you have something on your body. If it falls off, that's a problem, right? You're not getting what you need. So I agree with you. I think the cure, the prevention should still be a major, major focus. And I'm very excited to see that we are finally moving the needle on this. I mean, how many times have you heard a cure is 5 years away?
50 years now. Right, exactly. Yeah. Right. We've been hearing it for our whole careers. Right.
Right. And so I don't know if the cure is 5 years away, but I know that we have gotten a lot closer. The fact that we can delay diabetes by a few years. And even the thing is, it's not just the delay, right? Because it's also the preservation of those yes. beta cells.
Right.
So even if you say, okay, well, the person got 2 or 3 extra years of not having type 1 diabetes. Well, when they did get it, what were those first few years like?
Right.
Maybe they were a lot easier. Maybe they were able to be managed on, you know, initially a long acting or just a little bit, you know, a tiny bit of insulin. They weren't having these wide fluctuations in glucose levels. If we've improved their quality of life for several years, that is something.
Have we not done? Right.
That's something really big.
Right. I agree with you wholeheartedly. I also loved her discussion around adding other drugs. This is not going to be the one and only drug that is ever going to be used to delay the onset of all kinds of autoimmune diseases. They're looking at Crohn's. They're looking at other groups are looking, other companies are looking, right? And I think that's important too. Is there going to be where we say you have these 3 antibodies, but you don't have this one? Can we make that person a cocktail in the future to delay the onset longer, to prevent? What if you could get to 10 years? Would you do that? You know, those are the discussions in right. the future that we can have.
Yeah, it's definitely very exciting. Well, thank you for this very rich and informative discussion. And thanks to our audience for tuning in. If you enjoyed the content, please subscribe to our e-newsletters to receive upcoming MedCast episodes and other great content in your inbox.